You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is A Million Other Choices, and I am your host, Kim. Today's case, I got a lot of publicity here in Canada, and so for today's telling, I've used a number of different sources from the CBC, Global News, Innocence Canada, the Toronto Star, just to name a few. But the best and most extensive detailed coverage comes from Malcolm Johnson of Toronto Life, who wrote a number of articles on today's case, and I want to make sure I give kudos to him for sussing out all the details and getting to the bottom of things. Just under an hour's drive from Toronto, heading almost directly north, is a wee little village called Queensville, with a population of only 632 people. The village itself consists only of a post office, a United Church, and a fire hall, which is connected to the community center, and a community park with a baseball diamond, tennis courts, and a playground, and the Queensville General Store and Restaurant, a converted old early 20th century house where you can buy cigarettes, a variety of sundry items, and of course snacks and candy. A favorite hangout for kids in the area. Even better, it was directly across the street from the park. And in this little village was born an adorable little tyke with a face full of freckles on November 29th, 1974, Christine Jessup. To her parents, Janet and Robert, and Christine was lively and vivacious and saw herself becoming a vet in her future. She was also active and loved baseball, but had a girlish side playing with dolls. She was described as happy-go-lucky and was always smiling and always with her dog Freckles, an active and very loyal beagle in tow, and she grew up to be a regular after-school customer at the general store where she would get her fix of bubblegum and Cracker Jacks, as did her older brother, Ken. For the kids in Queensville, the baseball diamond and the general store were really the only places they had to meet up and make their plans for after school or on weekends. Not only was it a town where all the adults knew each other, but so did the kids. So, being the 70s and such a small community, kids came and went from their homes, showed up on neighbors' doorsteps, and rode their bikes until the streetlights came on. And on October 3rd, 1984, Christine, who was 9, and her family prepared for an ordinary Wednesday. Christine got up and gobbled down a breakfast of her favorite cereal and caught the bus for school. And Janet watched the bus leave and went about doing her errands for the day, which did include going to visit Robert at the Toronto East Detention Center, where he was serving an 18-month sentence for something. I'm not 100% sure what it was, but I think he frauded some friends out of some money. It's not actually important to the family's story. It's just where she was that afternoon. According to Malcolm Johnson of Toronto Life, Christine had a very ordinary day at school, other than that they were given recorders in music class, and she was excited to show her mom and her brother Kenny when she got home. But Christine's mom wasn't quite home when she got off the bus, so as was her usual routine, she grabbed a nickel from where they had sort of a jar of change so that she could grab some bubble gum at the store and then meet her friend Leslie that she had said she was going to play with at the park after school. And Janet and her brother Kenny arrived home about 4:10, so they likely just kind of missed each other by about 10, maybe 15 minutes. Janet noticed that Christine's bike was still laying against the shed and the kickstand was damaged. She noted it, but she figured she'd ask Christine about it later. Inside, Janet didn't really take note of anything being wrong. Her backpack was on the counter and she had brought the mail inside. But upon reflection, she did remember thinking it was odd that her jacket was hung up on the coat rack, but on a higher rack than she could actually reach. Around 5, when she was wanting to get everybody cleaned up for dinner, she walked to the park to look for her, but she wasn't there. She came back to the house after calling for her and walking around her usual places and called Leslie, who told her that they were supposed to meet up after school, but that she hadn't shown. When the sun went down and that nagging bad feeling that was creeping into Janet's bones just wouldn't let up, she called the police. And immediately there were hundreds of volunteers and like it was like a shoulder-to-shoulder search of every field, every side road, every wooded area. But they did not turn up any signs of Christine. And for 3 months, Janet, Kenny, and Robert, who had been released early for humanitarian reasons, searched and kept her name in the media, pleading for her return. And they refused to celebrate Christmas that year, not wanting to appear that they had given up on her. Now, the York Police Department back in 1984 was small as it was. There was only really one officer for every 800 or so people. And a community like Queensville just didn't have abductions or bad things happen. I mean, it was the middle of the day, practically, and she was like only off the bus for like 10 minutes. So the police in the town at first were on the hunt for an injured or lost 9-year-old, not an abducted child. So I can't completely fault the responding officers for taking Christine's coat off the hook and throwing away the plastic wrapper on the newspaper that was brought in or letting neighbors and well-wishers come and go from the house during the time that followed Christine's disappearance. But hindsight being what it is, evidence was lost in that time frame. There are really no two ways around it. But they did interview and talk to friends and family in the off chance that she hadn't just wandered off and fell down a well or something. But I don't think I would necessarily call them interviews. More like passing conversations. Like when Janet and Robert's good friend Heather Hoover came by the house the day after Christine disappeared to offer her support from her home in Toronto, Sergeant Bunce asked her where she was yesterday and she answered at work, and he accepted that without trying to verify it. Now, Heather didn't abduct or kill Christine or anyone for that matter, but still, usually they would look into whatever you tell them just to make sure because everyone lies. And Heather and her husband Calvin were on the list of names that Janet had given police of anyone that were allowed in and out of the house when somebody wasn't home, which was actually a fairly long list. It was a very small town, like, and doors were not locked. And if you've never lived in a small town, that's exactly how it works. Like, my ex-husband was from a very small town, and I was always surprised at people that would just sort of walk into an unlocked front door without knocking. I personally found it to be rude from my big city slicker ways, but everyone always found it completely normal, and the impromptu visits were always welcome. But anyways, I'm just saying you'd think that they would look into what they were being told, but months went by with no sign of Christine. Now, just before the new year to herald in 1985, the Patterson family over in Sunderland, which is about 50 kilometers east, had lost their dog somewhere on their large rambling property. Fred Patterson suited up his 2 daughters and together they trudged through the snow to look for the pooch. And walking along this matted down bit of grass that had sort of made a trail, Fred spotted a pile of garbage next to a pit that had been half dug and then abandoned. And he was somewhat annoyed that somebody would dump garbage, but it turned out it was anything but garbage. Instead, he found the crumpled, badly decomposing body of a child wearing a light brown turtleneck with a blue sweater. And next to her right foot was a pair of girls' underwear and a recorder with Christine Jessup scrawled in Jiffy marker on the side. And Christine had died of multiple stab wounds to her chest, a few deep enough to reach her spine. An autopsy would later reveal that she had also been sexually assaulted.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy 2, get 2 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Christine's remains were found in Durham County rather than New York, so Christine's missing person case was now a homicide moved to the Durham Regional Police with Detective Robert Brown as the lead detective. And the pressure to find justice for Christine and her distraught parents had begun. Now, according to reporting from Malcolm Johnson, it was then that Robert Brown made his first mistake, and that was creating a bit of a contest out of the investigation. I mean, he didn't really do that, but what he did do was tell his two teams of detectives that he had sort of divided the investigation into, that whoever brought him a suspect would get the chance to take over the investigation. One that I might add would be a case of a lifetime for them. Despite the fact that they were dealing with the brutal sexual murder of a small child, it was something that detectives all had sort of at the back of their minds. Enter Detectives Bernie Fitzpatrick and John Shepard, known on the force as the duo Fitz and Shep. Fitz and Shep took possession of the York Constable's notes with the names and addresses of a number of family members and family friends, but they mostly just figured that the York police at the time didn't know what they were doing, so they didn't bother looking at any of the names. They were, however, quite convinced that whoever had killed Christine had lived in Queensville and was probably known to the family, which seems like that list might have been important, and likely contained the name of Christine's killer. Many years later, they would learn that it in fact did. On Valentine's Day, Fitz and Shep paid a visit to Janet and Robert and grilled them for a list of suspects. They said that they couldn't think of anyone that they hadn't already provided names for as having access to the house and who knew Christine. Well, what about your neighbors? Well, I don't know. The Morins lived next door. They were a nice family, though. Alphonse and Ida and their six kids. Alphonse had very nicely agreed to be an emergency contact for the school if they couldn't get a hold of her or Robert. He's a retired engineer, was in the army. Ida was a nurse. She has a garden and cans beets in the winter. Most of the kids are grown and out of the house, but their two youngest still live with them. And that kind of piqued Fitz and Shep's interest. Their son was 25-year-old Guy Paul. No criminal record, though, not a drinker or drug user. Janet did notice that the family, including Guy, had not participated in the searches for Christine. And she did find that a bit, not really odd as much as just one of those things that you just kind of notice, like who comes when those kinds of things happen in your life. Janet had also mentioned that all she really knew about Guy was that he played the clarinet and did some beekeeping. So Fritz scribbled in his notebook, clarinet player, weird type guy. Guy might have come off as a bit weird. He had that same engineer brain that his dad had and liked to take mechanical things like clocks apart and put them back together. And he preferred puzzles to people and had a photographic memory. He was also a musical prodigy. And to me, that seems a little bit more Asperger's and less serial killer, but to Fritz and Shep, the young and handsome Guy Paul smelled like a rat. So a couple of days later, Fitz and Shep pulled up to the Morin house and asked him to chat. And they asked him how well he knew Christine, and he said not really well. He told them that one time Freckles got out and he had helped her wrangle him up. They chatted about his mum's garden, and once he remembered that his dad went over there to help relight their pilot light on the furnace, and he shrugged and said that was about it. And where had he been that afternoon that she went missing? At his job at Weston & Steeles, which is a furniture manufacturer. And where's that, you ask? About 57 kilometers south. He punched out at 3:32 p.m., so traveling at 100 kilometers an hour on the highway. That's 1.67 kilometers a minute, so 34 minutes, putting him at the earliest that he would be home at 4:06. And Janet and Kenny arrived home at 4:10. Tight, very tight, but not impossible, I guess. So why didn't he help with the search for her? He said he didn't know that him and his dad were in the middle of replacing the weeping tiles, and it just seemed like everyone in town was looking, so how much could they really help? Well, what did you think of Christine? He said that she was sweet and innocent, and then sort of filling in the silence that made him uncomfortable, he added, they sometimes grow up to be corrupt. And with that, Fitz and Shep were pretty sure they had their guy, but they needed some evidence. And a couple of weeks later, Guy was asked by his band leader, whose friend was doing a project for her hairdressing class and needed a few strands to analyze. and Guy volunteered no problemo. Only this classmate's friend was an undercover cop who sent his hair off to a forensic lab run by Stephanie Niesnick. Turns out there was a hair found on a necklace that Christine had been wearing with a hair on it. I can't even wear necklaces because my hair gets all tangled up in the chains, but they didn't believe that the hair was Christine's. Stephanie said that with the naked eye, the hair pulled from Guy and the one from the necklace were the same color and used the magic word consistent when looking at it under a microscope. And with that, Fitz and Shep won the contest, which, to be fair, they never actually said it was a contest, but let's face it, it was. Of course, Guy Paul was not even slightly aware that he was being considered as a suspect in a horrible rape and murder of his young neighbor. Fitz and Shep also hired an FBI profiler to help them develop a profile of who could have committed such a heinous crime, and the profile was rather robust. But Fitz and Shep didn't like all the stuff that it had to say because not all of it fit with Guy. So they just kind of went with pieces that did, like drawing a generic sketch of a white guy between the ages of 19 and 26 and presenting it to the media saying he's a high school graduate, lives in Queensville, wears sloppy clothes, and Alphonse joked, "My God, that sounds like you." On April 22nd, Guy was on his way to band practice when Fitz and Shep pulled up behind him with his lights flashing. He slowed and stopped, figuring it was because he wasn't wearing his seatbelt, but was relieved to see it was just Fitz and Shep, whom he was familiar with, and said in a friendly tone, "What's up, guys?" Needless to say, he was a bit incredulous when they took him in for questioning over Christine's murder. But he went along with them because he figured it had to be some kind of mistake, and he would be able to sort it out. After all, Guy had an alibi. He had clocked out at 3:32 and stopped for gas and groceries on the way home, and so he didn't get home until 5:30. Janet was sure that she had arrived at 4:10, and Janet was so sure about the time because she had an important phone call that she had to make before 5, so she had looked at the clock when she walked into the house. But her clock was probably just running slow, to which she said, "I guess that's plausible." And they filed charges of murder against Guy, and the trial presented basically a circus of evidentiary missteps and misguided tunnel vision. Once Guy had been determined to be the best suspect, they never bothered to look any further. And I wasn't able to find much reporting that was able to paint the evidence that they did have as anything other than, at best, reaching, and at worst, blatantly lied about. There were red fibers found in Guy's car. I don't remember learning that Christine had been wearing anything red, but they were presented as a definitive evidence that Christine had been in Guy's car. It turns out that the lab tech had been wearing a red sweater when testing scouring items from the car for fibers and never bothered to put a lab coat on to prevent contamination. Police had collected a discarded cigarette butt from the scene, but Guy didn't smoke, so that valuable piece of actual evidence was mysteriously lost. And one of the officers at the crime scene, well, he kept two notebooks, it turns out, one for his initial notes and one where he rewrote them to better suit the Guy did it story. That officer later faced charges of perjury. They had a psychologist that testified that Alphonse and Ida testifying that Guy hadn't gotten home till 5:30 that night while they were just protecting their son. Police had planted an undercover cop in Guy's cell just to make sure they had a confession under their belt. The officer asked Guy about his favorite movies, and Guy had told him the one where the kid says red rum, which is like murder backwards, which we all kind of know is The Shining. The officer later testified that he had made stabbing motions at his chest and that he would red rum the innocent, which was a complete fabrication. Of course, all of the evidence against Guy was reported in the media. And Guy was a smart kid. He'd asked his lawyer about this DNA thing, and couldn't that help him? But it was too new of a science at the time, and it wasn't used because it was too confusing for a jury. Fortunately, the jury didn't buy the evidence, and they found him not guilty. Now, I say fortunately for Guy and his family, but the Jessups had spent more than a year being told that Guy had killed and raped their daughter, and believed that, and having to live next to the man that had done such an unforgivable thing seemed like hell that none of us should have to conceive of. For the Morin family, it was still a hell as well, as the threatening letters and rocks at the window became a regular thing for them. The Crown prosecutor, whether driven by embarrassment or just a hate-on for Guy, who he truly believed had just gotten away with murder, appealed for a new trial on the grounds that the jury hadn't been given the proper definition of reasonable doubt. And they presented the same evidence that they had before, but Malcolm writes that this time they had a theory of what Guy had done to wind a tale for the jury. Guy had come home from his work at 4-ish. He saw Christine with her recorder and lured her into his car by playing his clarinet to entice her. Seriously, that was their theory. She was lured to a man's car by the sounds of a clarinet. Guy had seen this opportunity when he saw that she had a recorder and decided that this was his ticket to get her to trust him. And once in his car, he drove out to Sunderland, where he raped and stabbed her repeatedly, started to dig a grave, gave up, and drove back home, arriving around 5:30 like nothing had happened. But this time the jury bought it and convicted him. And the now 32-year-old Guy Morin was sentenced to a lifetime behind bars at the Kingston Penitentiary, a place that doesn't take kindly to child killers. But fortunately for Guy, a bit of a storm was brewing outside the walls of the prison, protesters believing in Guy's innocence. Enter Guy's new lawyer, James Locklear, whom some of you Canadians will recognize his name from Innocence Canada. Now, just so you know, I loathe writing episodes of wrongful convictions because I believe for the most part in our justice system. I believe that the majority of police want to help, maybe not as much as like street cops, but detectives. Homicide detectives, I believe they want to find real killers and not made-up killers. And I'm glad that Detective Dave Sweet from here in Calgary assured us that things have changed quite a bit and tunnel vision thinking gets squashed by a group effort. And I think that there is a lot of pressure on police when crimes like that happen, like what happened to the Jessup's family, to find the guy and get him off the street. I think we all want that. But a wrongful conviction is not justice for anyone. It doesn't help the family, it doesn't get the killer off the streets, and it certainly doesn't save us taxpayers any money. So I don't like putting out there in episodes that, hey, this happens. But it does, unfortunately, as I believe this is my fourth episode now with a wrongful conviction based on tunnel vision thinking. But if you're listening from outside of Canada, they happen in every jurisdiction. And if the police had told us that the Pope killed Taylor, we probably would have believed them and put our anger at him because we believe them. They are professionals, they are working for us, and in this case, I'm upset and angry for Guy and his family, but also for the Jessups. They went through hell here. They trusted that the police wanted justice for them and wanted to find Christine's killer, but they just wanted a face to put on it and figured that it was good enough for closure for them. How many years did the Jessups have to endure feeling that their neighbor had killed their child? Anyways, I don't actually know how many years they believed it, but in 1993, James Lockyer filed an appeal and he was actually granted bail to await this appeal. And this was, of course, after Guy's parents had mortgaged their house to pay all of his legal bills. But this time, Lockyer was aware that DNA had come a long way, and Guy was 100% agreeable to testing the semen sample that had been found in Christine's underwear, which thankfully they had preserved. And wouldn't you know, it was not a match to Guy, and he was released and all was well. Only it wasn't, because imagine being Guy. He's just released, exonerated by DNA, with a public that still didn't even understand DNA, junk science let that guy off on a technicality. So suspicion and anger continued to follow him. I mean, can you imagine for the family? What do you mean they released him? He killed our daughter. You said he killed our daughter. What do you mean you were wrong? You told us you knew he was the guy and now he's just out. The killer of our daughter is out just free. I cannot even imagine what that's like for both families. Anyways, the lieutenant governor wanted to get to the bottom of this debacle and ordered a commission to do an inquiry into how all this happened. And in 1997, it was released, a 1,380-page report with 119 recommendations on how to do better going forward. Fortunately, with advancements in technology and forensic sciences, they don't happen often anymore. But it's a bit laughable that the possibility of wrongful conviction is the number one reason the Supreme Court of Canada gives for why we don't extradite anyone to a state or a country that has the death penalty. So it sounds like even they don't have a lot of faith in the system. Tunnel vision on a single suspect is still at large in some jurisdictions, it would seem. But the case of who really killed Christine Jessup was cold. The file was given to the Toronto Police as a cold case, and it stayed cold until May of 2019, when a rather astute detective, Steve Smith, took on the case. And Steve was also in attendance at the seminar about forensic genealogy that I talked about in the Sophie Surgi case, where the detectives learned the wonders of running DNA from crime scenes through 23andMe sites for familial ties. So the samples they had were sent to Othram and narrowed it down to one Calvin Hoover, which is a name that Steve had not read in any of the notes from the detectives in York or Durham. He scoured them. And there in one of the York notepads was an interview that he saw the last name Hoover. But the first name wasn't Calvin. It was Heather. The notes indicated that Heather was a good family friend and was listed as one of the family's close contacts, as was her husband, Calvin. At the time of Christine's murder, Calvin was 28 years old. He was living in Scarborough with his wife and four kids and working at the Eastern Independent Telecom. Calvin did installations for them, and his wife was in dispatch with them. And Robert Jessup, Christine's dad, had been a lead hand installer. And it turns out that during the workday, Calvin had a bad habit of leaving one site and taking his sweet time about getting to the next one, leaving him with a lot of unaccounted time. Robert and Calvin had become friends from work, and Heather and Janet became pretty much best friends, spending hours together at family gatherings. Heather was known by Kenny and Christine as Auntie Heather. Heather had been particularly distraught over the loss of Christine, whom she had often babysat for and had played with her own children, and had rushed over the next day to comfort her friend. And there she had met with one of the York detectives, who asked her in passing where she was the day before, and she had said at work, which, remember, they never bothered to follow up on, and they never even talked to Calvin. Both Calvin and Heather had been at the memorial service, and they both sincerely gave their condolences to the family. Calvin and Heather had moved to Oshawa after Christine's murder, and I don't know if they kept in much continued contact with the Jessups after that, but Heather never forgot little Christine and kept a photo of her on their mantle. Robert and Janet would eventually divorce, as would Heather and Calvin, but for different reasons, obviously. Janet and Robert had found the loss of their child, like, it was a strain on both of them, grieving in different ways. But for Heather, her marriage crumbled over Calvin's debt. He declared bankruptcy in 1991, but also was depressed and anxious, leading him to a pretty nasty problem with alcohol. All of it likely because he had a secret that he was keeping from Heather. By 1996, when Guy was exonerated, they had moved into a low-rent housing unit in Ajax, and his drinking only got worse, as did his gambling, and he started to rack up DUI charges, and so she peaced out. And after his divorce, Calvin continued to drink and gamble, but did manage to find another sucker to marry him in 2003, but she had gotten sick soon after and died in 2009. And then in 2015, Calvin was living with one of his sons in Port Hope in a small rented place, and one night when alone in the house, he drank a bottle of wine, took a bunch of anti-anxiety meds, taped up the garage door, and turned on a gas generator. His son found him the next morning with a post-it note on the bathroom mirror that simply read, "I hope you all have a good life." No deathbed confession, just that. And the coroner's office that dealt with Calvin's body had miraculously left two vials of his blood in storage, and it turned out to be a perfect match to the sample that was found in Christine's underwear. And when the Jessup family got the news, Kennedy said of Janet, "For the first time in 36 years, she won't go to bed praying to find out who killed her daughter. It's a miracle. I can't find another word for it." And Janet didn't really remember Calvin from so many years ago, that he had worked with Robert. But she remembered Heather as her friend, and she referred to her as her funny friend. Robert said of Calvin, whom he only vaguely remembered, "If I could, I would line him up and blow his brains out." Neither of them ever suspected that he was a murderer and a child rapist. And as for Guy, he settled with the province of Ontario for $1.2 million. He gave half of it to his parents to cover their legal bills. He married, he worked for a time as a baggage handler at the Pearson Airport, but suspicion continued to follow him. Exonerated or not, it really didn't matter. And him and his wife moved out to the country on a plot of land that he purchased, and he now repairs pianos, preferring to work alone and socializing only with family. He was relieved to hear that they finally identified the real killer, a man that he had never heard of, but to this day, he remains pretty distrustful of the police. And that was the terrible murder of Christine Jessup and the wrongful conviction of Guy Morin. And I don't really know how to feel about that ending. On one hand, you want these guys to live a long life so that they could suffer for a long time, and so that when you find out it was them, they're alive. But on the other hand, they don't really deserve to be out living free and just living their lives. You know, when they murdered someone years ago, I guess I'm not sorry that he's dead, but I'm sorry that they just never really got the justice. And, you know, maybe in his life he did suffer. Let's hope that he suffered in his life and that his alcoholism and his marriage falling apart and all that stuff was about what he had done to Christine. And I really hope that that was his suffering. And with that, I'm going to be back again next week with another case. In the meantime, you know what to do. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.